This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's college application season, and across many kitchen tables are strewn those beautiful brochures of cozy New England campuses. But as students weigh their choices and possibilities, in the background is the worry, how do I know the college I pick will be around in 4 years? We saw Mount Ida College close abruptly last year, and this year, Newberry College in Brookline, along with 3 schools in Vermont, closed. WBUR's Edify team has been taking a closer look at the challenges facing small nonprofit schools all this week and what they're doing to survive in a series called Small Colleges, Big Challenges. Edify reporters Carrie Young and Max Larkin are with us to talk about it here in Studio 3. Carrie, Max, hello.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Tiziana.
It's great to have you both. So why did you want to approach this in a series of stories? And why now? What makes this the time to tell these stories?
Yeah, well, I mean, this series was really born out of several conversations our team was having about coverage that we were doing from the last year's really big news stories, from those closures that you just mentioned to the legislation that followed and the different legal proceedings that we saw as well. And, you know, right now, we really do have lawmakers and accreditors trying to just get their arms around the situation to make sure that other college closures don't go the way that Mount Ida did, because arguably there could be a number of institutions that are kind of on the edge right now, given the market.
Yeah, and so we looked at a handful of institutions, 4 in total, 2 that are kind of in that dicey moment where, you know, they're really trying to find their way out of a snare, and then 2 that seem to have weathered that moment and are on to something new.
So right now, what does this picture look like, and should we be expecting more closures?
I think that's we want to have some restraint there. We're not talking about a doomsday scenario. It's been speculated that half of all colleges are going to close. I don't think we have evidence for that. Just for some context, Tiziana, Moody's Investor Services, the credit rating group, found that about 11 institutions close each year nationally. That's double the previous 10-year average, but that's still relatively small in a country that's dotted with tons of little private communities, colleges and the like. And so I think what we have to do is learn from the Mount Ida episode. I think it shocked all of us how quickly that happened and the fallout mm-hmm. from that. And these institutions are fragile, so we want to be watching them. But I don't think we should prepare for an apocalypse.
The series laid out the problems facing the kinds of schools you just mentioned, but it also went in-depth on some of the fixes. There are a few different approaches that colleges seem to have taken to stay open. One is merging with another school. We saw that Mount Ida tried to do that with LaSalle College, but that fell through. Carrie, is that the first thing a school jumps to when it's facing a challenge like this?
Yeah, merging is typically not the first on the list of options. You know, typically in all of my conversations that I had with the different college presidents for this series, their board of trustees tried to put together a variety of options on the table. And that can include anything from layoffs to reducing the student body, doubling down on grant applications or philanthropy. And then also merging is typically on that list, but it's one of many. So this was something that Mount Ida board chairman Carmen Reese really did forcefully point out when she testified before lawmakers last spring, shortly after the school announced that it was closing and regulators cried foul.
We had a robust, carefully thought through strategic plan. So it was not hope. It was strategy. And we ran into obstacles. Not all plans to save things work. Ours did not.
Really, though, merging is, again, not high on that list of options, at least at first, because when a school does merge, there could be a lot of changes in store for a school community.
So let's stay with mergers for a minute. What dominoes have to fall in line for a merger to actually happen? I know you looked at Hampshire, which didn't merge but tried to.
Yeah, well, I wish there was a really clear-cut answer there. Obviously, there is negotiation involved, determining your non-negotiables and things you are willing to give on. Leadership has to be in agreement. But there also, it seems like good communication is pretty key in this type of situation. Merging comes with change, and that needs to be communicated well, and it seems like early with the school community. We heard a lot from the students from Hampshire College when the news hit that they were considering a possible merger there. And a student, Luke Gannon, he told New England Public Radio something that resonated with a lot of the students that we heard from there. Let's hear what he had to say.
I think if we merge, especially with a school like UMass, our values are going to change. But on the other hand, I don't want us to completely go off the grid.
Again, it's that idea that, you know, they were scared about losing what made Hampshire, Hampshire, their really unique approach to education. Now, it should be mentioned that not all mergers really mean that total takeover. Wheelock, for example, did manage to keep a lot of their non-negotiables, as they called them, when they merged with Boston University in 2018. And full disclosure here, BU holds the broadcast license for WBUR. But the former president of Wheelock, David Chard, told me a big reason for their managing to keep their non-negotiables was that his school specialized in an area where the larger institution was hoping to grow.
So, Max, your piece this morning focused on Pine Manor College in Brookline. They took a different approach by specializing. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story, Tiziana. This is a predominantly white women's college for the first 80 years of its history. And then at a certain point, that model doesn't make a ton of sense anymore. You don't have young women seeking it out. And so they made this compromise or this pivot that made sense with their values, deciding to invite more diverse student body to campus. And by now, Pine Manor is 85% first generation, meaning their parents didn't go to college, 85% low income, predominantly Black and Latino. Students who are first generation and low income tend to take longer to get their degrees than other students and to drop out of college in higher numbers. So today's Pine Manor is trying really single-mindedly to fulfill this mission, to respect those students, all they've got to offer, and to guide them to graduation. I heard from the college's president, Tom O'Reilly, on that score.
They have a lot more challenges sometimes, but they have the perseverance and the grit to keep going.
So, Max, tomorrow you're looking at Regis College. What are they doing differently?
Yeah, they made a similar – they were in a similar situation to Pine Manor, where they were a women's college feeling a little less than keen about their prospects of going on. But they went in a different direction. They went really doubled down on advanced career-focused work, especially in nursing and health sciences. Regis is really a university by now. Two-thirds of the students are graduate students or learning online. And, so they had to look at what they were in, say, 2005 and kind of choose a new direction. I don't want to give anything away about the story, Tiziana.
Don't
but
give
I think
anything that, away.
I think
I mean, I'd love for you to give something away, but
I think they're in a lot better shape now. And so they're taking in revenue that has allowed them to expand. They just opened a campus in Lawrence 5 years ago. And they acquired the dental hygiene program from Mount Ida and are now have sort of welcomed those students into the fold.
So let's talk policy for a minute, because the impacts of these small college closings, really, they could be very big for students, but also people who work there, the communities that support them. What's the legislature doing?
Well, there are a few potential policies making it through Beacon Hill right now. The Senate actually is expected to take up a measure next week, and that would require things like more financial disclosure from these colleges, more financial training for board members. And, you know, there is a concern by some in the college community that having something like this would mean that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy by making it more public, that they're on the edge. It could just start that spiral. But, you know, those negotiations and debates are ongoing at this point.
Max, there's a lot to dig into here. Briefly, what most struck you after working on the series?
I guess I was struck, Carrie and I both talked to a lot of senior administrators, the extent to which these people think of their little colleges, you know, sort of these little havens away from the working world, they think of them as businesses. They think in terms of branding, smart expansion, smart acquisition, cutting costs. And I just think that's a bit of a revolution from maybe 50 or 100 years ago when a lot of these colleges were already open.
So many valuable lessons in this. That's WBUR Edify reporters Max Larkin and Carrie Young. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Tomorrow on Radio Boston, we will dig into what parents and students should consider when choosing a college. Stay with us. Coming up, Governor Baker's new health care bill has rekindled the debate over statewide reform. We'll look at what the bill does and doesn't address. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.